Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We have a busy show for you today. Coming up in the second half, Dr. Tom Ezern with The Smell of Paint, reflecting on North Dakota's artist and poet, Clell Gannon. And beef prices are soaring. We have a report from Harvest Public Media with an interview with a rancher, a butcher, and an economist to explain why and when they might ease. And in Alaska, hunters and scientists team up to protect walruses as climate change reshapes traditional practices.
The Lawrence Welk Show.
As we begin Main Street today, we talk about an event that was held last night at NDSU's Memorial Union Gallery at North Dakota State University. The North Dakota State University Press launched Champaign Times, Lawrence Welk and His American Century, a three-volume biography of North Dakota's own Lawrence Welk. The author, Dr. Lance Ritchie, is president of the University of St. Francis in Indiana, and he was there at the celebration to talk about Welk's journey from a prairie farm boy to a titan of American television, and he is my guest today. Welcome, Dr. Ritchie, to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. It's great to be here.
I want to talk about Lawrence Welk's North Dakota roots. There are people here who don't know who he was. He was born and raised as a German Russian in a farmstead in Emmons County. How did those early years on the prairie shape the man and the musician that he became?
Well, when I was in researching my book on Lawrence, I spoke with his last secretary, Margaret Heron Letterman. She worked with him for the last 30 years of his life. And when she described him to me, she said, he was always a North Dakota farm boy. He never shook his roots. He never hid his roots. He was really the embodiment, I think, of Midwestern values of that era. And that's what made him such a success in America.
What values or traditions did you gather from your research, from his immigrant background, that really carried forward most visibly into his career and his television persona?
Lawrence was raised in a German-speaking town, Strasbourg. German-speaking family, didn't learn English until he left home at 21. Raised in a very devoutly Catholic family on a farmstead that his parents had established in the 1890s when they came over from near Odessa. And as a result of his childhood, he left school in fourth grade when he got sick for a year and had to leave school. He never went back and worked on the farm. And I think between his commitment to small town values, a personal Christian faith that really shaped him deeply, and also just the work ethic of growing up on a farm, those are the things that most shaped his personality. He was a devout Catholic, but at the same time didn't put it in the front. But it was the values that he embodied, and I think people sensed that his traditional religious values, his commitment to traditional rural values, were at the heart of everything he did.
Many North Dakotans, of course, still claim Welk as one of ours. You talked about his secretary saying he was always a North Dakotan. What does his story say, Dr. Ritchie, about the Great Plains as a place of cultural capital?
If you watch the Lawrence Welk Show on TV, especially in the 60s and 70s until it went off the air in the early 1980s, there is increasingly, I think, a rustic quality to it. A throwback to simpler times. In many ways, late in his career, Lawrence became a nostalgia merchant. And that was a nostalgia for simpler times, for simpler values. The musical family, the performers that he had on the show that people identified with, you know, in doing my research, people said they looked like the folks next door. They weren't glamorous Hollywood stars. They weren't people that you could never be like. They looked like people you would meet in your own hometown. And Lawrence always made sure on the show that the ethos and the values that were being communicated were ones that would resonate with rural, small-town America or people in the big cities who had that in their background and remembered it fondly.
you made a decision to tackle his life and his legacy as a biographical project. Your book, just launching now, published by North Dakota State University Press, Champaign Times, Lawrence Welk and His American Century. What made you want to do this? And when did you decide? How did you decide?
Well, it's an interesting story, interesting to me. About 15 or 16 years ago, I ran across his autobiography, Wonderful, Wonderful, which he wrote in the early 70s, late 60s, at the end of his network TV run. I found it in a bookstore for a dollar, bought it and read it, and just kind of put it on a shelf. I'd always been interested. I was a history major in college, and 20th century culture, 20th century American history have just always fascinated me. And as I read about Lawrence, I realized his life really tracked the American century. He was born in 1903. He died in 1992. And his career started in the 20s and didn't end until the 1980s. So as I walked through his life, I found I was walking through the history of America in the 20th century. And I just got drawn into it. And at one moment in life, you say, I think I'm going to be a Lawrence Welk biographer.
Your wife helped with research. Your wife, Carol. Dr. Ezern talked about her skills and the partnership shaped the scope and quality of the biography. How did that relationship work as you're producing a book?
Well, my wife is a genealogical researcher. She has a love for Midwestern and American history as well. She grew up a Nebraska farm girl. And as I was researching, really everything came together at this moment for this book to be written. Thanks to Dr. Tom Ezern of North Dakota State University and Dr. Suzanne Kelly, the publisher of NDSU Press, there was institutional support saying this project matters for North Dakota. This project has merit. Michael Miller of the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at North Dakota State University, a native of Strasbourg, and a relative of Lawrence, became the passionate driver of the project. Dr. Robert Groves of NDSU, about 30 years ago, had begun researching Lawrence and done dozens of primary interviews with people who knew him. And thanks to their help, it really pulled together. I thought when I began writing it would be a small, popular work. But as I discovered the importance of Lawrence for America, as these scholars helped me find resources, the book became a major scholarly project. And my wife, Carol, was a key part of that. In the last 10 to 15 years, thanks to the internet and computer technology, hundreds and hundreds of small town papers from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, have been digitized and are searchable online. And so for the first time, someone researching a traveling a regional musician in the 1920s and 30s is able to find the contemporary evidence for where Lawrence was, what was he doing, what was his band like. She was pivotal to that. She really has a knack for detailed archival research and the digital research required. As a result, throughout Lawrence's entire life, there's only one summer, the summer of 1927, where I don't know where he was within a few days. And really, that's the result of my wife's incredible research. She was able to track down endless, endless newspaper references, letting me know where he was at, where he was traveling. And that man traveled a lot, let me tell you.
Tell me about Lawrence Welk's wife.
Lawrence married Fern Renner, and she was really the perfect wife for a North Dakota farm boy. She was a North Dakota farm girl herself. She grew up in Mandan, also the child of German from Russia immigrants. She studied to be a nurse, and they actually met in Yankton, South Dakota. She went to Yankton to study at a nursing college, and he went to Yankton to play on the radio, WNAX. And she would come down. She came down to the radio station to watch him play, and he fell head over heels in love with her on first sight. and she didn't have much use for him. So he had to court her for months and months before she would finally give him the time of day. But she finally saw in him the kind of man that I think he was, a fundamentally decent, good, and caring man. They married in 1932, and they had 60 happy years together.
Dr. Ritchie, as you alluded to, and as Dr. Ezern shared with our listeners in an essay that he wrote, there's never been a scholarly publication project in North Dakota of this weight about Lawrence Welk. Do you see this as setting a new standard for regional biography?
I don't know if I'm one to make that judgment. I hope that the book that I wrote shows people that North Dakota history, regional history, tells us profound things about what America was and how America became what it is today. We now have, as I said, the digital resources, the scholarly resources through the work of generations of historians to understand regional history with a complexity and a nuance that I think in the past was covered up. We're no longer at a stage of history either where people want to forget their immigrant roots and just assimilate. Understanding that journey that Lawrence made and that I think generations of immigrants made, where they slowly became what you'd call mainstream Americans while keeping a very distinctive ethnic identity, you can discover that now in a way it was more difficult in the past.
This was appointment television for millions of Americans. In fact, when he was at his greatest relative to his television reputation, 12 or 13 million Americans would tune in to watch The Lawrence Welk Show, which blows away any network statistics that we get today. Why did Americans like to watch The Lawrence Welk Show?
Lawrence gave the people what they wanted. He was an entertainer. He wouldn't describe himself as an artist. He loved jazz music. He loved Dixieland. But he said, I don't play much of that on my television show because the audience wants something different. Lawrence's greatest success on network television actually came in the most tumultuous times of the 1960s. He hit the top 10 of all television programs in 1968, in 1969, when the nation was coming apart at the seams with the baby boomer revolution, with the Vietnam War, with the civil rights movement, because everyone knew for 1 hour a week, I can check into Lawrence Welk and I'll hear music I recognize. I won't have politics in my face. And I can just for a moment step away from all the turmoil and enjoy a show that presents to me the America that used to be or that I imagine used to be. That was Lawrence's secret.
This is the man who performed, as you said, during the Depression, through World War II, through the 60s, different cultural revolutions. How did he manage to stay relevant yet true to his values in these tough times?
He did so by targeting the audience that wanted that and staying with them. His audience aged with him. By the time he went off the air in 1982, the average viewer of his show was probably late 50s or into their 60s, but they had been with him for 30 years. He tried to draw in young people, but he knew that wasn't going to happen. So by the mid-1960s, Lawrence knew that the baby boomers were not going to be his primary audience, but their parents were. And so he played for their parents. And the children remember him because the parents made them watch the show. That was his secret.
During those times, did he have an impact in defining mainstream American entertainment because he didn't try to perform to the baby boomers? He didn't try to gather an audience that wasn't in his wheelhouse, so to speak?
Absolutely. When he went on national TV in the summer of 1955, he was scheduled for a 13-week replacement show, and it was just a trial. By 1956, he was the biggest star on television. The year of Elvis's breakthrough, Lawrence Welk was on television the most important entertainer in the country. And throughout the rest of the 1950s and throughout the 1960s, he was a household name in the country. It wasn't until really the baby boomers seized control of popular culture by around the early 1970s, that he began to be forced off his perch. But really, as long as the World War II generation was in the driver's seat of the culture, Lawrence really provided the soundtrack for them in many, many ways. And that's what kept him alive until that generation really began to leave the scene.
I remember watching Lawrence Welk as a young person with my family who gathered around our television set. And Tom Ezern shared with us that there really is no sordid side to Lawrence Welk. I think my parents thought that as well. How unusual is that for a cultural figure of this stature to have such a stellar reputation? And how did you approach writing about a man who largely, from my perspective, lived up to his values?
That's what drew me to him originally. When I read his autobiography, really the decency of the man, the integrity he had about his core values of faith and how one ought to live one's life shone through. I'll say when I began writing the biography, I often had anxiety whether I'd learned something that diminished him in my eyes. I went through dozens and dozens of interviews with people who worked with him for decades. I interviewed other people myself. I went through countless newspapers, magazines, trade journals. There's just no dirt out there on Lawrence Welk. He was deeply committed to his wife. He was a faithful, happily married man. Was a difficult marriage at times because he was a workaholic. But literally, I never found any reference to anything the least bit scandalous. He was too busy entertaining people and making money to be distracted by those things.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Lance Ritchie. He's written the book, Champagne Times, Lawrence Welk and His American Century. It's a 3-volume biography now published by North Dakota State University Press. You just said that one never knows what one will discover and that he lived up to what we believe to be just a wonderful life. Yet, I'll bet there are still misconceptions that people might have about Lawrence Welk. And in telling his story, did your research find any and do you try to correct them?
I think a major misconception that people have, they don't appreciate how personally religiously devout Lawrence Welk was. He lived in an era, his popularity in the 50s and 60s and 70s, it was an era that was increasingly secularizing. He did not want to get into religious denominational debates. He himself was a devout Catholic. He employed people of all faiths. But on a personal level, his religious faith really shaped who he was. His longtime secretary actually told me that what most disappointed her about the books that he wrote about himself was that he would not speak publicly about his faith in a way that expressed how important it was to him. He didn't want to alienate people, so he kept his faith private. But it was a very deep and serious faith that from the time he was a young boy until the day he died was an integral part of who he was.
I think people sometimes dismissed him as maybe being corny. We remember the bubbles, the champagne bubbles and the bubble machines. Did his music change through the years in what he wanted to present to us, the American public?
Lawrence's musical evolution is really fascinating. His first records were cut in 1928, and they were very jazz age, jazzy pieces, really contemporary to what would be popular music of the time. During the big band era, he was a big band star. And then in the 1950s, he shifted into much more the popular vocalist strain. By the 1970s, on his TV show, he's playing all the big hits off pop music, not rock music, but pop music. But Lawrence, as he went on television, he was always a laggard when it came to popular music. He would play almost any music once that music had been sanitized and become part of the landscape. part of the wallpaper of our society. So he was never a cutting-edge musician. He wanted to make sure that by the time he played music, it would be music that people were comfortable with. There was a little rock and roll on his show occasionally, lots of pop music in the 70s, but it was always music that he would start playing it once everyone was comfortable with it. So he evolved with everyone else, but he evolved 3 to 5 to 10 years behind the curve that the rest of society did.
Why was NDSU Press the right place for you to publish your book?
North Dakota State University holds the Lawrence Welk Archives. It is a center for Lawrence Welk Studies. The NDSU Press and the Institute for Regional Studies, I think, are the premier location for research on Northern Plains and the region's cultural heritage. It also includes the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection. All the things that made Lawrence who he was, the farm country, the immigrant culture, the values of the state. North Dakota State University Press and the Institute for Regional Studies, this is what they're about. It really is a blessing for North Dakota. I do wish that people appreciated fully how unique North Dakota is in embracing and preserving and educating the people about who the state has been, because that's what makes it, in my opinion, one of the greatest states in the country.
What do you hope your readers take away, Lance, from reading all three volumes, not just about Lawrence Welk, but about the American century that he lived through?
What I learned from the book, at the end of it, I had answered a lot of questions for myself, I believe, about what was America in the 20th century? How did America make the transition from, at the beginning, overwhelmingly agricultural, hugely immigrant, multilingual, with a very fractured culture, to by the 1990s when Lawrence died, the America we know today, mass media, kind of a common cultural vocabulary, and a very secularized view of the world. Lawrence's life traced that arc out, and I came to understand through him how my grandparents, how my great-grandparents, and to a certain extent my parents over the years, navigated these broad cultural changes. I think you'll also find in the book that the values that we often dismiss in popular culture, in Hollywood, on television, the rural values, the traditional values, they live on in a lot of ways that people don't talk about them, but they live them out and they seek them out in the marketplace. Lawrence was a success because he knew his audience, he played to his audience, and he never challenged their beliefs. He rather played into their beliefs, and he embraced them and they embraced him back.
Dr. Ritchie, what's next for you?
Arrest right now. It's been a decade-long project. I first came to North Dakota in 2015 when I came to the archives at North Dakota State University to begin my research. And here we are 10 years later. What was intended originally to be a small volume turned into a 3-volume magnum opus. But along the way, I learned a huge amount about a man. I learned a huge amount about North Dakota. And I learned a huge amount about how much that man and this state contributed to the America we live in. So I'm still digesting that in my own life. Maybe I'll find another North Dakotan to study. Peggy Lee may be awaiting for me.
My guest has been Dr. Lance Ritchie. He's the author of Champaign Times, Lawrence Welk and His American Century. It's a 3-volume biography now available from North Dakota State University Press. And he spoke on campus at NDSU's Memorial Union Gallery last night. Dr. Ritchie, it has been a pleasure. Congratulations on your work.
Thank you. And keep up the great work for the state of North Dakota. I love it very much. And it's my second home now. And maybe one day it'll be my first home.
We would welcome you for sure.
In those days, the world's most beautiful ballrooms. Here's Wayne's familiar theme, gentlemen.
Still to come on Main Street, Dr. Tom Ezern with The Smell of Paint, reflecting on North Dakota artist and poet Clell Gannon, and beef prices. My, they are high. Harvest Public Media interviews a rancher, a butcher, and an economist to explain why and when they might ease. Let's hope that's very soon. Plus, in our living lands, in Alaska, hunters and scientists are teaming up to protect walruses as climate change reshapes traditional practices. That's all ahead on Main Street on this Tuesday. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this is Plainsfolk with historian Dr. Tom Ezern. Today's essay, The Smell of Paint, revisits the life and work of Clell Gannon, a painter, poet, and true son of the Dakota Prairie. His words and images captured the land's colors, its spirit, and its contradictions, offering us a chance to rediscover what it means to belong to a place.
There is a word out of fashion in this era of specialization, referring to a notable type of individual, the polymath. A polymath is a person of multifarious talents and expertise who walks in several intellectual or artistic worlds and blends them with imaginative results. I envision two sets of circumstances that would generate the polymath. The first is a wonderfully rich and affluent intellectual environment, providing time and resources for leisurely tinkering. The other is an environment more spare, as to formal and financial resources, but rich in social and sensual stimulation, where a single imagination has to do the work of many. You can guess which of these two situations has been common historically in North Dakota. Maybe still is. Exhibit A. Clell Gannon, a painter, poet, and person of imagination who called Bismarck his home by raising and by choice. And my text for today is the republication of Gannon's 1924 book of poetry, Songs of the Bunchgrass Acres, courtesy of the Digital Press at the University of North Dakota. I have spoken here of Clell Gannon before, and do so again in a new foreword, in which I encourage all of us to rediscover his work and the sense of place exhibited by this son of the land. The new entrance to Gannon's work is a thing of beauty, cover art, by another polymath, Max Patzner, visual artist, singer-songwriter, author of children's books, and a lover of all things North Dakota. Gannon would love Patzner's color-rich collage on his cover, and Patzner would love the contents behind it, including Gannon's poetic manifesto, The Law of Dakota. For the law holds each son of Dakota who wanders away from the sod, though he be native-born or adopted, disciple of Satan or God. Gannon, as poet, as painter, as folk architect, witness his rocky home in Bismarck, the Can, was an exponent of the sense of place, whose role in our cultural lineage is situated by Molly Rosem's landmark book, Grasslands Grown, Creating Place on the U.S. Northern Plains and Canadian Prairies. Grasslands Grown is Grasslands Grown, authored by a book from Mitchell, South Dakota, and I read it as a son of the plains, as Molly is a daughter. We both claim Gannon as brother. We understand what he is about. Maybe another prairie brother, Aaron Barth, understands it better than anyone else, having devoted a chapter of his dissertation at NDSU to Gannon, and thus provided the perceptive introduction to Songs of the Bunchgrass Acres. Bringing it to print was the work of another polymath, Bill Carraher, and all of us have the smell of paint on us. Clell Gannon, you see, said the prairie, after a refreshing rain, is so colored it smells of paint. I mean, Bill, you should have made the cover of this book a scratch-and-sniff item. This is the stuff of place that builds the larger, constructed, and constructive regional identity of the Great Plains. You can get hard copy from Amazon or download a free PDF from the website of the Digital Press of the University of North Dakota. I leave you with a conundrum from the book's title, Bunchgrass Acres. Bunchgrass, that's the prairie primeval. Acres, that's a term of agricultural transformation. What is this land anyway? And Clell, Molly, Max, Aaron, can you help me out here? Can we go home again? Is it still there?
That was historian and distinguished professor of history at NDSU, Dr. Tom Ezern, with Plains Folk. Today's essay, The Smell of Paint, reminds us that the prairie life is as much art as it is history, and that voices like Clell Gannon still echo in our cultural landscape. You can find Gannon's Song of the Bunchgrass Acres through the Digital Press at the University of North Dakota, available in print and as a free download.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, accepting applications for the 2026 Bush Fellowship, September 2nd through October 7th until noon Central. The Bush Fellowship invests in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Up to 30 leaders receive $150,000 to support their self-designed leadership plan. More information at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Beef lovers are paying more than ever, and the end isn't in sight. From the cattle pastures of Texas to a small-town butcher shop to the desk of an agricultural economist, Harvest Public Media asked three people who know the industry best, why are beef prices soaring, and when might they drop?
The Barton Creek Farmers Market pops up on Saturdays in a shopping mall parking lot high on a hill in Austin, Texas. Richardson Farms' booth is tucked into the far back corner.
We raise beef, we raise pork, we do eggs and chicken, we have milk and we have cheese that we make.
That's Jim Richardson, who owns the farm. He and I are talking under a tent while his grandson fetches items out of a fort of coolers. His beef products include stew meat, steak, and ground beef. Lately, they've become pricier.
I went up roughly $1 a pound. My processor went up that much or more, so without kind of keeping up, it erodes your profitability.
Richardson's worked with cattle as a rancher and a veterinarian for more than 50 years, so I asked him about the cost of beef.
Do you have any notion of when prices might come down again?
You know, I don't, and I'd say it's going to be years. It's a real complex issue. And it's not going to remedy quickly.
The big reason why beef prices are so high is that the U.S. cattle herd is really small, the smallest since the 1950s, in fact. Years of drought in cattle country have forced ranchers to sell animals. As the population dwindles, each cow becomes more and more valuable.
So we sell those, and that means then that we don't grow the herd. And that's what the situation we've been in here for a while.
That's Brenda Botel, an agricultural economics professor at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Despite the costs, she says people are still buying beef.
I'm actually surprised at how resilient beef demand has continued to stay with the very high prices.
At 36 General, a small butcher shop and grocery store in San Marcos, south of Austin, Maddie Bills says that high prices have forced her to pay closer attention than ever before to what ranchers and suppliers charge her.
Checking pricing quarterly because things are fluctuating has been really important for us surviving it all.
Bills buys pork, lamb, and cuts of beef from local ranchers.
Obviously we get ribeye, tenderloin, strip. Denver is a really popular cut of ours, which is a better value, but it's still really marbled and tender.
The shop is crammed with display cases for cheese and proteins, plus coolers along the walls with veggies, sausage, and chicken feet. In the back, workers marinate ribs, cut sheets of butcher paper, and grind black pepper. Phil said she didn't have a good estimate of when beef prices will drop again, but she has noticed that when buying direct from the source, prices don't tend to jump as dramatically.
Prices have definitely increased across the board. I will say that the more local the product, the more insulated it is from price increases. You know, like the further away you get from the source, the more likely you're going to be playing a game of telephone, and somewhere along the line, someone's going to increase the price and not bring it back down.
So at every step along the beef supply chain, the costs add up. And Battelle, the Wisconsin economist, doesn't expect the high prices to come down anytime soon.
When I'm talking year over year, I don't really see that declining at least through 26.
In fact, she believes prices still have room to go up, at least in the short term.
So I think your August, September, October, we'll still see prices increase.
So those planning a late summer barbecue will need a healthy budget if they plan to serve beef.
That report comes to us from Michael Marks with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media stations across the Midwest and Great Plains, covering food, farming, and rural life. You can find more stories at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Walrus is a key subsistence food for indigenous communities in Alaska's North Slope, but climate change has shifted walrus habits. Hunters and researchers are working to understand these changes and document traditional knowledge. The Alaska Desk's Ayona Naiden reports on the collaboration.
Growing up, Robert Kaumaluk Lisburn remembers walruses starting to beach near Point Lay in large numbers. It was always an exciting time for local hunters, but he says a stream of boats and gunfire startled the animals, causing them to rush to water and crush some of the young pups. Since then, Lisburn says hunting practices have changed.
When they first started coming, everyone was hunting them. So we came together and we said, we gotta find a better way to hunt these animals without causing the stampede.
Lisburn is a hunter and a member of the North Slope Borough Fish and Game Management Committee. He says Point Lay residents now try to hunt walruses when there are only a few of them on the beach. They also ask pilots and mariners to avoid flying too low or boating too fast near the animals during haul-out. Lisburn will share his knowledge about walruses with the U.S. Geological Survey and the University of Alaska Museum of the North later this summer. The project will include a walrus drone survey and interviews with local hunters who rely on them for subsistence. The information could also shed light on local climate change effects. Eduard Kirkitagins-Dor is an anthropology postdoctoral fellow at the University of Alaska Fairbanks who will help with the interviews. He says the goal is to document Inupiaq knowledge about walrus haulouts, the conditions of the animals, and what can be done to preserve them.
This is about how to help local community to deal with modern challenges, including climate change.
Zdor is a Chukchi indigenous leader, originally from Chukotka in eastern Russia, where walrus is also a traditional subsistence resource. He also researched and advocated for subsistence hunting back home. Zdor moved to the U.S. 10 years ago to study at UIF. Walrus research is one of many areas where Russian and American scientists, as well as indigenous experts, used to work together. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022 put a strain on the relationship between the countries and on research collaborations. Zdor says he would like this project to be a link between Chukotka and Alaska.
This is what we are dreaming about. Me and people like me here in Alaska and in Russia as well, my fellow local villagers, of course we are. It was a long time ago, almost 30 years ago, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and we just realized that we are not alone here in the Arctic. Our neighbors, they are really the same.
In Alaska's Arctic, female walruses traditionally rest on sea ice, but the trend has been shifting. That's according to Anthony Fishback, a wildlife biologist with USGS who has been leading walrus population surveys.
After 2007, things really changed where sea ice would dissipate in almost all years.
Fishback says that now the vast majority of female and young animals from the Pacific walrus population, which means tens of thousands of them, come to Point Lei beaches and feed for several weeks before migrating over to Russia.
And that was a fundamental change in their behavior.
Lisburn has been working with walrus biologists, making sure they follow safety protocols during regular surveys and don't harm the animals.
We subsistence hunt these animals, and it's a part of who we are. We've been working together, Native Village of Point Lei and the walrus biologists. We're protecting the animals.
For Lisburn, the opportunity to exchange walrus knowledge with Store from Chukotka is exciting.
They get more walrus than we do on our beaches on Russia side. They get the double amount. So it's going to be interesting to work with Edward and learn from him too. And we're going to be learning from each other, actually.
He says that some walruses are slowly starting to approach Point Lei right now, though it's still unclear whether there will be a massive coastal haulout this year. Zdor says it will take several years to analyze the interviews and share the final narrative with the village. It can be helpful for working with wildlife management agencies, he says. After the project is done, Zdor says he hopes Lisburn will continue documenting local knowledge. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You can tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl. This free family event is October 4th and 5th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, fabric artists, jewelry artists, group studios, and more, all demonstrating their work. Peruse the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
Here's some recent positive stories from H2O Radio you might have missed.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
And I'm Franny Halperin. What do you get when you mix seawater with recycled soda cans and coffee? According to researchers at MIT, you get green hydrogen, a clean source of energy that many hope can replace fossil fuels.
Current methods to create green hydrogen are expensive and use electricity from renewable energy sources like solar or wind to split the hydrogen from the oxygen and water. It differs from the cheaper blue hydrogen that uses fossil fuels to extract the element.
Last year, the MIT team looked for less costly ways to break water that didn't contribute to climate change. They knew that aluminum generates hydrogen when it comes in contact with water, but don't think you can just drop a soda can in a bucket and expect a chemical reaction, because once aluminum has been exposed to the air, it forms a protective oxide layer, and the process stops before it can get started.
So as lead researcher Ali Kumbari explained to H2O Radio, they experimented with ways to penetrate that oxide layer to harvest the aluminum and found that an alloy called gallium indium did the trick.
Unfortunately, that alloy is rare and expensive, so although a great way to get pure aluminum into water and create hydrogen, it wasn't sustainable.
So they went to the beach. Instead of fresh water, Kumbari says he scooped up some seawater near Boston, which it turns out can capture the alloy so it can be used over and over.
Great, right? Not yet. The seawater converted the aluminum to hydrogen really slowly, so Kumbari had to be resourceful again. He and his team tinkered in the kitchen, looking for ways to speed things up. And we all know there's a substance in our houses that amps us up, and it worked here too. Caffeine.
When they added coffee grounds to seawater and the aluminum, the reaction was fast, producing hydrogen in 5 minutes compared to 2 hours without caffeine.
Next, the team tested their aluminum-based hydrogen to power an electric vehicle and an EV bicycle. Kumbari says the bike ran for 2 hours before needing another feeding of hydrogen, and says the solution has potential for ocean-going vessels because you wouldn't have to carry around seawater. It's right there.
The research has been met with much enthusiasm because ocean water is abundant, and aluminum is Earth's third most common element. Furthermore, the solution doesn't use fresh water, which is constrained around the globe.
More good news is that the method creates byproducts called baymite and pyrite, which are in high demand to fabricate semiconductors, electronic elements, and many industrial products, meaning their hydrogen solution would be both sustainably green and economically in the black. And finally, Magellanic penguins are named after the Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan, who saw the birds in the early 1500s during his first voyage around the tip of South America.
While his crew used a quadrant and a compass to find their way, they could have learned a thing or two about navigation from the penguins, so says a new study.
Researchers from Swansea University and the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior say the flightless birds have a secret strategy for finding their way home after swimming far from land, which they do to find food for their chicks.
The birds, which are just over 2 feet tall, can't really get their bearings in rough seas by sticking their heads above the water to look for landmarks. So how did they know which way to go?
To find out, the team put GPS devices on penguins from a colony living off Argentina's coast and discovered that instead of swimming in a straight line back to shore, the penguins often followed curved S-shaped paths driven by the currents.
They say the birds seem to sense both the presence and strength of these currents and to understand tidal cycles in which water moves first in one direction and then reverses. If the penguins were carried too far out by a tide, they seem to know they'll be brought back in later.
The study found that the birds could stick the landing and arrive within 300 meters of their departure point, some even at night.
This remarkable navigation strategy helped the penguins not only to conserve energy, but also increase the amount of food they gathered simply by taking the long way home.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 9th. On this date, in 1910, newspapers reported that the battleship USS North Dakota had suffered an oil tank explosion and fire at sea. Six crewmen received the Congressional Medal of Honor for extraordinary heroism in the line of their profession. Commissioned into the Navy in 1910, the North Dakota had a mostly peaceful career. Although present during the U.S. occupation of Veracruz, Mexico in 1914, her primary mission during World War I was training new sailors for the rapidly expanding Navy. The ship stayed on active duty until the early 1920s, then was converted into a radio-controlled target ship until 1930, when it was replaced by the USS Utah. At the time of her construction, the North Dakota was the largest and most powerful battleship in the world. The Navy had wanted two new ships that would improve on the British HMS Dreadnought. The North Dakota featured an additional turret, and all 10 of its main guns could fire on the broadside, unlike the Dreadnought. But the ship was controversial. While it was being built in 1907 and 1908, critics, including some in the Navy, claimed its design was flawed, its guns were weak, and its turbine engines were inferior. The debate played out in journals like the New York Times and Scientific American. The Grand Forks Herald acknowledged the controversy, but assured readers that the critics were off base. The Fargo Forum ran a front-page headline calling the ship Uncle Sam's biggest peacemaker. In 1921, the USS North Dakota took part in joint Army-Navy bombing tests that sank two ex-German battleships in an air power demonstration. She later resumed peacetime training, including summer midshipman cruises to Europe. Unlike her sister ship, the USS Delaware, North Dakota did not see combat during World War I. Both ships were decommissioned on November 22, 1923, in Norfolk, in compliance with the Washington Naval Conference Treaty, which limited naval armaments among the U.S., Great Britain, and Japan. The North Dakota was disarmed in 1924 and reclassified as unclassified. Once newer battleships, the Colorado and West Virginia, entered service, North Dakota was ordered scrapped. She was sold for dismantling in 1931 and towed from Norfolk to a shipbreaking yard in Baltimore. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lee Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll discuss a difficult but urgent topic, suicide. North Dakota continues to face some of the highest suicide rates in the nation, and September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. Dr. Alexandra Kolhaes, clinical psychologist at Essentia Health, joins us to explore this year's theme, Start the Conversation, Be the Difference. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.